Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to... God, this is stupid already. Hello. Welcome to another episode of Broadway Breakdown, Subset, My Obsession. I am your panelist, Matt Koplik. With me today is the one, but not the only, Charlotte Maltby. Hello, Charlotte.
Where are all the other ones?
I don't know. Locked in a basement somewhere?
Yes, I hid them from the world.
I don't know. I've been watching a lot of SVU. I feel like that shit happens a lot.
More than you'd think.
More than you think, yeah. This has gone well. Charlotte toured the country as a governess to a bunch of bratty children in The Sound of Music.
Yeah. All my years of babysitting really paid off on that one.
Well,
and Hebrew school.
Oh, how long were you in Hebrew school?
I mean, until my bat mitzvah.
Right.
Weren't you there?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, we weren't friends yet.
No, I like just became, because yeah, I just became friends with you like
a year after.
Yes, it was.
Oh yeah, Matt and I go very far back.
Sorry, yes, this is all very,
there's a lot of nostalgia
happening. This is all inside baseball right now. Yeah. I have known Charlotte for 13 years.
Since I was 12.
Yes. Well, I knew your sister Emily a little longer than I knew you.
Right.
You and I became friends when we famously did a production of Little Shop of Horrors outside. Take that, Regent's Park Open Air Theater. We did it first.
Ayo.
Charlotte was a lovely 13 years old while I was 17. And
it was kinky.
It was very kinky. I waited all my life to finally get a lead, and Charlotte shows up being tall and is like, I'm going to get a lead.
They're like, hey, she looks like she hit puberty. And I was like, I'm barely dead.
But it was fun. Anyway.
We have a hootenanny.
We have a hootenanny. Charlotte just came back from the West End, where her father, Tony Winner, Richard Maltby Jr.
Winner with a silent Q.
Winner. Oh, God. I feel like this is only going to be fun for us.
Oh, I'm sure. This is going to be insufferable for everyone else.
Charlotte's father just opened up a revival of Big the Musical, which Charlotte was present at. If you listened to last week's episode, you know that I know a lot of things about Big. I'm going to put Charlotte on the hot seat right now because I have some questions based on this week's episode. She's not prepared for this.
Oh, gosh.
True or false? Dancing All the Time is still on the show.
True.
Fantastic. Next question for you. Say Good Morning to Mom is still put back in?
Yes.
Okay.
They have both Say Good Morning to Mom and This Isn't Me.
How does that work?
It was too much.
it's too much.
Mostly just because you know the transformation is going to happen, and immediately all you want is for the focus to be on Josh.
Yes.
And then when you start with Good Morning to Mom, and then you're just waiting for
yes,
it.
Yes, I agree. Other hot seat question. Is the slushy dance break still on the show? In its time, the act two opener.
Oh yeah, with the
da 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 da. Is that still in it? Is that still in it?
Duh.
Okay.
Duh. How could you not?
I'm aware. I know this, and you know this.
That's like the piano dance.
It. You know what?
Maybe not, because that's from the movie.
It's like cutting. I don't know what else is iconic. It's like cutting the opening audition in a chorus line. It's like, what's even the point if you don't have the... I mean, exactly. It's not a slushy dance because it's shaken like soda ice, but we call it the slushy dance.
I know, it took me a second to be like, what are you talking about?
But shorthand, I call it the slushy dance. Mike Bella calls it the slushy dance.
I mean, here's the thing. It's in the score. It's part of the show. You can't cut it. You can't get around it.
If Big did anything to the lexicon of musical theater, it gave us...
A young white Polish boy from Jersey talking rap.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. It made us go, oh, children can do this? Mm-hmm. Let's have all of our children do this in shows now. It, like, upped the game.
True.
So, like, we have Matilda and Billy Elliot now because of Stroman and that dancing teen chorus.
Damn straight.
Billy, I'd like to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top.
Charlotte has also never listened to an episode of Broadway Breakdown, so
I'm irresponsible.
All the jokes that you guys now know from this podcast are new to her.
Woohoo!
But today's not about me. Today's about Charlotte and her obsession. Because in Big the Musical, who choreographed Big the Musical?
This little choreographer by the name of Miss Susan Stroman.
And Susan Stroman also choreographed a production of a musical, of which is Miss Charlotte's obsession.
And it is a production that I like to call Strokelahoma.
Which is not a porno.
It is not. Although it has its moments.
It does.
Thank you, Hugh Jackman.
Yep. So,
Strokelahoma. I think I had my sexual awakening watching this show, which is tough.
Yeah. I wish I could tell you what my sexual awakening was. It's all a blur. It was one big 5-year period. It was a slow burn and then it popped.
Yikes.
But so Strokelahoma is code for what show?
Oklahoma, as choreographed by Susan Stroman. And this is the 1998 London production starring Mr. Hugh Jackman, as well as Shula Hensley, as Jed.
Josefina Gabrielle. I can give you one other name, but Josefina Gabrielle as?
As Laurie?
Yeah.
Also the first Laurie to dance her own dream ballet, which is why this production is the best worst thing that ever happened to me, is because while it made Oklahoma one of my favorite shows, it also ruined Oklahoma from being a show that I could ever do, because no one wants to see me dance my own dream ballet unless you want a wacky wailing inflatable arm flailing tube man.
You could do the dream ballet in the current production. I feel like that's how you dance naturally.
With the butt scoots.
Yeah, that's absolutely how you dance.
That actually is something that I do in my spare time.
Scooting your butt across the floor is not the worst use of your time. However, it is a waste of your butt.
Not your butt specifically.
I'm using the royal hue. So everyone's butt.
It's a waste of one's butt.
It's a waste of one's butt. Your butt can do so much, y'all.
Or a way to wipe a butt of one's waste. How's that for grossness?
And wordplay.
Son of a lyricist.
Before there was the Oklahoma that fucks, there was the Oklahoma that dry humped.
Indeed.
And that's how I would describe this Oklahoma, because it's not like it goes all the way balls deep, but it goes decently.
It tickles the balls for sure.
Absolutely. So how did you come to know this Oklahoma, this version of Oklahoma?
I saw it in London as a munchkin. I don't have very much memory of it because it was 1998 and I was a zygote. But I also saw the Broadway production starring Patrick Wilson and then had the DVD of Strokelahoma starring Hugh Jackman. And that was just like one of those things that was like very much in the Mulvey family zeitgeist. Sure. It was like that, Music Man, Singing in the Rain. Those were like
your mom loves the Music Man.
Oh, we as a people love the Music Man.
I just remember.
Oh, maybe that's what we should have talked about.
We could have, especially since it's coming back. But we don't have to.
Next time.
Next.
Bring me back for that because I have lots to say.
Fantastic. I have to bone up on the Music Man. I need to remember more of it since Sutton Foster is apparently now a soprano. So
I mean, here's the thing: Sutton Foster is actually the only person I want to see play Marion.
Really?
I was actually like really, really perturbed that they're doing a revival of Music Man, because I was like, do we need another ingenue? Because I have a very specific vision in my head of who this girl is, and I've never seen it done that way. And hearing that Sutton Foster is doing it, I was like, oh, get the fuck ready. Yeah. I'm here for this. Also, starring Hugh Jackman. What up? How about that? First segue back.
How dare you make us go back from a tangent to the topic, Charlotte?
Hey!
Clearly, you never listen to this podcast. We go on tangents all the damn time. And I will say for the record, because I said it before, I am totally here for Sutton Foster's Marion. When it was announced, it was the thing that made me go, oh, I actually think this production might be interesting.
Yeah.
Because I do think that I do think we're going to hear a lovely soprano from her. We heard a very little bit of it in Drowsy Chaperone.
Her voice is beautiful.
It is, but people forget what she can do because she doesn't usually do soprano. She'll do like a mix that's sort of in the mask.
Yeah.
But that's not
She has the capability strength. Because yeah. You can tell by the lightness and the placement of her voice. She has that instrument.
Charlotte went to Michigan.
But it's the same thing with Jessie Mueller, how no one was expecting her to be this soprano.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you've heard her voice. Like, she has different colors, and all you need is a voice teacher to be like, okay, instead of placing it there, place it there, bada bing, bada boom, soprano.
Speaking of turning soprano roles on its head.
Hey!
Welcome back to Stroklahoma.
Yes!
And Hugh Jackman. Mm-hmm. So you saw when you were a zygote. I understand that. I was 5 when I first saw Les Mis. Yes. But still, you went off to London to see this, which is
insane. We're the Mopies. We go... It's a high-stakes theater game.
Absolutely. Did you see it at the National, or did you see it when it transferred to... Why am I asking this? How would you know? When it transferred to the Lyceum?
I'm fairly certain that we saw it at the National. Okay. But
it's a big block of a building.
All I really remember from seeing it in London mm-hmm. was the teeny train that goes across the stage.
That train is everything.
That and like the mini versions of the set that's like mm-hmm. on the side of the set to show that like where we are and that how that's in the distance. Yes.
That set was the first set I saw live because I saw it on Broadway too after owning the DVD. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I had seen a set that did like forced perspective. I've never seen things like that before, where it's like, you have...
I don't think it's ever, like, really been done like that before.
Yeah, not to that level. I would say, if anybody has done it before or since, it's Bob Crowley, but he does it in a very different way. He does it, like... production was very abstract in its design.
Yeah.
But also, like, sometimes very literal. Like, you would have
It definitely
house.
Had a lot of literal versions to it, but yes.
Yeah, like, you had the farmhouse that they were living on, and then, like, it was on a turntable, and we all know how much I fucking love a turntable. That turntable would turn, and all of a sudden, just, like, a model set of the farmhouse would, like, be behind, and all of a sudden, we're, like, across the field
and
now.
And it's weird because you really get a sense of, like, oh, we're on the plains, yes. And, like, there's nothing between here and there.
Yes, the vastness of it all was was heavily emphasized in this production.
Precisely.
Yes, and that, so you remember the forced perspective and you remember the train.
Yes, I also remember as a kid, whenever someone would ask me who my idol was, I would say Hugh Jackman, mm-hmm. because he was someone who was in both musical theater and in movies. Mm-hmm. Of course, I did not know at the time that he wasn't the only person to do that, but he was the first person that I knew who did that,
sure.
So I was obsessed with that, about how he was, like, such an amazing crossover.
And I mean, you both have big dick energy, so I get it.
Ew. Anyway, so Hugh Jackman has a big dick. Moving on.
Yes, and one day, I plan to see it.
Should we all be so... Yes, Ravenclaw mug! Sorry, he's just, like, sipping out of a Ravenclaw mug, and I just got very seen.
Yeah, I've got a Ravenclaw mug and a Paddington Bear.
I watched Paddington 2 3 times this past week.
I saw your Instagram story the other day.
Yeah.
Yes, that movie is perfect.
It's perfect.
It's the perfect screenplay. We're getting off topic, which is what we always do. I tell everyone, so the year Paddington 2 came out, and they're like, Matt, what do you want to win Oscars? And I'm like, the one movie that deserves adapted screenplay is not even nominated. Paddington 2 is a perfect screenplay, because every single detail... is used again. Mm-hmm. It all comes back into play.
Including the coin in the ear.
I know.
That's what he uses to call the fan.
Well, so there's this statement from Chekhov that's like, if you show a gun in act one, you gotta fire it in act two. Like, don't just show us stuff for the sake of showing stuff. Like, it mm-hmm. has to be important in any, like, in any way. It can be for character development, plot development, whatever you want. Paddington, this is the, let's change gun to coins. Just why not? Paddington 2 has a million coins, yes. Half of which you didn't even know were coins.
Yeah. And also half of which you don't even realize were until, like, the second time around.
Yeah. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant, perfect screenplay. The movie itself is delightful and made me cry when he's reunited
also,
with his aunt.
That fucking cast. When he's reunited with his aunt, mm-hmm. When he almost drowns, ugh. And when the Browns don't show up to visiting and he cries.
Or, how about this? I texted my father afterwards, who's obsessed with Follies, and I said, Father,
get out.
They use a song in Follies constantly in Paddington 2, and I guarantee you it's not the song you're thinking of. And he gave me 7 song options, and I said, no, 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 no. Because no one ever thinks of Rain on the Roof when they think of Follies.
No.
Listen to the rain on the roof go
Also, because the world needs Hugh Grant as just leading a big musical dance number. Absolutely. In a pink prison jumpsuit.
Hugh Grant is an international treasure. You know. Correct. Who's also an international treasure? Hugh Jackman.
Hey!
Hey! Oh, we're back.
Yeah, so, I thought I could talk about Paddington 2 for a very long time. I'm glad you did that.
Charlotte Maltby was 4-ish. You might have even been 3. Because it was summer of 98.
5.
You were 5?
This many?
You're 4? Not 3 years younger than me. Yes, you are.
Am I? What's
are you?
Math?
How old am I? So.
Anyway.
It stuck with you.
So Hugh Jackman. Yes. For multiple reasons. One, because Oklahoma just like plays such an important part in just like musical theater history, and like its foundation. It basically was the first. I mean, there is Showboat,
mm-hmm.
but after Showboat, it's the first Rodgers and Hammerstein musical,
mm-hmm. which is very important,
which is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And it basically is the first real story-driven book musical where mm-hmm. the scene leads to a song, and the song continues to forward the action of the scene, mm-hmm. as opposed to here's a scene, we're gonna stop the motion, and then I'm gonna sing about my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you take the songs out of the script, the show does not exist.
Exactly.
And that's the mark of, like, a true good musical.
Actually, at this very moment, I realized, I do think that Oklahoma is the first musical to not have a single number that is a diegetic number. Does that make sense? Because Showboat does have songs that, like, propel the plot and character development, but it also mm-hmm. has a bunch of songs
totally.
That are... like, actual musical numbers. Like, in musicals, you have diegetic and non-diegetic.
Mm-hmm.
And the lines get crossed all the time when the show's about people in, like, the entertainment business, like Cabaret. Cabaret always is going in that gray area. I think, mm-hmm. from what I can understand, Oklahoma is really the first one that has completely non-diegetic numbers that also propel the plot forward. Because yeah. until then, you had stuff like Showboat or Pal Joey... which did have character development numbers, but also had a lot of, like, here's a musical number.
And now here's a number.
Yes. And then everything else was shows like, if you took development to the American musical in your college, you'll know this theater, the Princess Theater, where mm-hmm. Jerome Kern used to cut his teeth. Is that the term I want to use?
Gross.
But, yes, the Princess Theater had a lot of shows that were, like... a lot of them, the way you can best describe them, like college musicals, like No, No, Nanette, where it was a lot of, like, there was the plot, and then the song would happen. So it would be yeah. things like...
And the songs were all popular songs.
Yes. Often to become popular songs.
Yes,
yeah.
exactly. And they were all songs that, like, people would listen to and, like, sell the sheet music for, and mm-hmm. would be playing on the radio and
yes.
stuff. And...
so it's like, a scene would be to propel the plot, and then the song would be to be a break from the plot. So
exactly. It kind
would
of like opera.
Yes. It's like, plot, 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 and then be like, hey, Charlotte, do you know what day it is? And then Charlotte was saying, it's Tuesday, and like, and everybody'd be like, oh yes, that's the big hit song yeah. from Hey, Charlotte.
Or they'd be like this big love scene, and then they'd have a moment where they just go, I'm in love!
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd be like, and 3 minutes later, I am in the same place
yes.
at the end of the song that I was when I started,
mm-hmm.
but maybe we kissed.
Yes. So whereas where Showboat kind of planted the seed and it slowly kind of started to sprout, by the time it got to Oklahoma, Rodgers and Hammerstein really were like, okay.
We get this formula.
Yes, let's take all the things that people have been, like, playing with
yeah.
and like, go balls deep.
If we're talking structurally,
mm-hmm.
Oklahoma is a perfect musical.
Mm-hmm.
Like, 100% beginning to end, it is a perfect musical. We can also break it down and say, like, yes, it does have its flaws, but just
sure.
purely in terms of, like, the book.
Technically
speaking,
yes.
it is a perfect musical. Yes.
Every moment is needed. You cut something, you lose something.
You lose something, exactly.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, that even goes to show that we have this revival right now, which is night and day different.
Mm-hmm.
And even still, they did not change a single word. That
yeah.
is really, really fucking telling that they didn't have to change anything
mm-hmm.
and the story still works and the show still gets told.
I think the best revivals are the ones that trust the text. Because
mm-hmm.
if you don't trust the text, don't revive the show.
If you don't trust the text, you think you're better than the text, in
mm-hmm.
which case that's arrogant, and just write your own show.
Yes. Yes, very much so.
Although I'm assuming we will get into this revival towards the end of this, and I have lots to say
About Oklahoma That Fucks or Stroklahoma?
Oklahoma That Fucks.
Okay, great. I mean, I have thoughts about it too. I overall really enjoyed it. I had some issues, but mostly just like aesthetic stuff. I appreciated them trusting the text on a lot of elements of it.
Yes.
Because we had come off of another Rodgers and Hammerstein revival where the director did not trust the text one bit, and I wanted... I understand he's a very lovely man, but after seeing that revival, I did want to punch him in the face.
I had some very sincere qualms with Carousel, mostly, but also Carousel, unlike Oklahoma, is not a perfect musical.
I think...
It has some serious... Oh, Carousel, when it is great, it is some of the best that musical theater has to offer, but when it lacks, it's also, oh, what a real nice climax, which is tough.
Yes. Well, so I would say, I would argue, there's a difference between... perfect and great. So, like, mm-hmm. I would say Oklahoma and South Pacific are more structurally sound than Carousel in the sense of, like, it's a lot harder to fuck them up.
Yeah, you can see a high school production of Guys and Dolls and be able to tolerate it.
Absolutely. And, yeah, like, there are shows like that that are just purely indestructible.
Yes. Hairspray is one of them.
Yes. It's usually the lighter shows, but they're being... Oklahoma can go pretty fucking dark, as we currently know. Mm-hmm. Carousel, cool. I would say, reaches... it's only because very personal for me because it is my favorite show. Mm-hmm. I think it reaches levels of greatness that very few musicals ever have, but it is also one of the most delicate shows to do well.
Yes, and you can do it poorly
so easily.
It is not a show that speaks for itself.
No, you really...
You really have to frame the story in order to make it sing.
And I would argue, even though because the score is so beautiful, and I wouldn't say it's... It's interesting when people are like, well, you really need strong singers. You do, because it's a beautiful score.
You do. You need actors.
Yeah, you really need actors.
Because if you look at the text of the bench scene leading into If I Love You, it is sparse.
It is.
None of them are saying how they feel. None of them are saying what they mean. So much of it is unspoken, and it's very, very easy to not get the point.
And when you think about it, it's about a 2-hour and 50-minute musical. Of those 2 hours and 50 minutes, I would say both Julie Jordan and Billy Bigelow spend a total of like... separately, but total of their time spent like about 20 minutes singing. That means there's about another 2 hours plus where they have to talk and act. Mm-hmm. So you really need good actors. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a perfect world, yes, they've got the most beautiful voices and are incredible actors as well. That's not always the case.
I mean, also, again, so going back to Oklahoma, what is her name in place, Lori?
Josephina Gabrielle.
Josephina Gabrielle is not the strongest singer.
No.
She's not the strongest singer, but she is a hella good actor. And as you see in the second act, as you see in the end of the first act, a gorgeous ballerina.
Yeah, she's a beautiful ballerina.
And you kind of forgive her for not being the strongest singer because she's an incredible, incredible actor. Mm-hmm. And she gives a whole new life to her that you never really see if you're going to compare it to, say, Shirley Jones in the movie, who is a very classic ingenue. Mm-hmm.
Very dainty.
Very dainty, very delicate, gorgeous singer, a little boring.
Yes. I'm always acting first. Josephina Gabrielle, they do change some of the keys for her.
They make
it more belty for her.
Yeah.
Which I like.
But you know what I love more than anything is that she walks out, makes her first entrance in frickin' overalls.
Because she's a farm girl.
And there is nothing I love more than a spunky ingenue. It is my favorite thing in the world.
Many a new face will please my eye, and many a new love will find. Never have I once looked back to sigh over the romance behind me. Many a new day will dawn before I do.
Which is part of why this production like means so much to me is because it's the first time that I had ever seen a soprano role with balls. You know, with spunk, with grit, with who's scrappy.
She fights back.
And so her relationship with Curly isn't like, like they're bickering with each other like an old freaking married couple, which makes it really fucking hot.
Yeah.
Oh my God. The people will say we're in love. Is so like, it's so cute.
The tension is great.
As well as the scene in the second act leading into Let People Say We're in Love when they finally like...
Same thing with If I Loved You and How I Loved You. Oscar Hammerstein understood the unconditional love song and he really originated it.
Damn straight he did.
Yeah, because in life, and it's what I love about Oklahoma and Carousel and all that stuff, the relationship between Curly and Lori is sort of... The only thing getting their way is pride.
Yes.
And I would say social norms. Because... And famously in the show, it's, you know, the farmers and the cowmen are butting heads.
Well, you know, one man likes to push a plow, the other likes to chase a cow, but that's no reason why they can't be friends.
First of all, how dare you fat shame people? I can chase whoever I want. And how dare you call my husband, Jonathan Groff, a plow? I will push him. But yes, pride, social norms, because it's very clear that they desire each other on certain levels.
Yes. I mean, it's very clear from their first thing. You're like, well, there's no reason for them not to end up together. You know.
Yes. But it's more about
it's the
how and the when. And you see, he's more open about the attraction, but it's similar like If I Loved You, where it's the I'm not gonna say anything till you say something. Mm-hmm. No, you gotta say it. And that's very realistic because our pride gets in the way all the damn time.
Well, it's a fear of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I don't want to
rejection.
Yeah, it's a fear of rejection. If you're saying I don't want to say this if you don't feel the same way, so if you don't say it first, I'm not gonna say it, even though
it's how I
everyone
feel.
Else mm-hmm. knows that we both feel the same way.
Yes. Yes. It's
unlike
lovely.
In life. I've never experienced that.
Charlotte has everything together emotionally, mentally.
I am in a very emotionally secure person.
Yeah. She's sitting.
I'm also a liar.
Anyway.
So.
Necessary.
So let's go back into Stroklahoma.
Yes.
So, and it's important that we bring up Carousel because.
Mm-hmm. It came next.
Carousel came first in the revival segment because I'm talking about Stroklahoma in terms of.
In
terms of being written, Oklahoma came first and then Carousel was the next thing.
Yeah.
In terms of revival expectations, I say this all the time. Before the 94 Carousel, which originated...
The Nick Heitner one. I call the definitive Carousel.
Ditto.
Did I tell you they got lunch with Nick Heitner in London? Lol. That's not necessary for this, but I just really felt...
No, but I need the audience to know that my face is stone cold. Because, god damn it, all I want to do is meet him.
I literally got off the plane, had 20 minutes to, like, shower and make myself look like a human, and then had lunch with...
Nicholas Heitner. Tony-winning, Olivier-winning director, former artistic director of The National, personally responsible for making The National internationally relevant to everyone via the National Theater Live broadcast. And brought them, I think, into their most, like, financially and artistically successful period. Because they were in a big decline before he came on.
Oh, yeah. And now he just created this new theater called The Bridge Theater, which I visited.
I went there, too.
Gorgeous.
It is gorgeous.
Right
their
at the
lobby,
base of London Bridge.
Their lobby is beautiful with the floating lanterns. I saw a production director called Alleluia when I was in London last year. I knew nothing about it, but I knew that he directed it, and I demanded to see it.
Correct, as well you should.
He's... Anyway.
So, Carousel, so before, the so definitive...
Yes,
94.
Which also originated at the National.
At the National.
Before that revival, most revivals of musicals, especially of the Golden Age, were more like nostalgic revivals. So they either were...
As opposed to reinventions.
Yes. So they were either complete recreations of the original, like Oklahoma in 79, or Bob Fosse's Sweet Charity, or Jerome Robbins with West Side Story, or they were kind of glowing homages, like Guys and Dolls with Faith Prince, or Patti LuPone in Anything Goes.
Yeah. And more just like, let's bring the show to a new audience so that they know that this show existed because they weren't around to see the original production.
Exactly. Like the historical value of it.
Exactly. It was more about honoring the place that these shows hold in musical theater history and keeping that alive as opposed to taking it and reinventing it for a modern audience.
Yes. And with Carousel, Richard Eyre, I think that's his name, E-Y-R-E, is that Eyre? Richard Eyre? He was the artistic
Jane's
director.
Sister. Brother.
Jane, brother of Jane.
brother of Jane.
He was the artistic director of the National at the time in the early 90s. He wanted to take Golden Age musicals, and he was like, what if we examined them like they were... Miller or Shakespeare. Yeah, yeah. Miller, well, classic text.
Or contemporary text.
Yeah, contemporary text. And then Nicholas Heitner was like, well, yeah, he found the script of Carousel. He's like, this seems surprisingly relevant. He was very taken aback. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, what if I treated this was written today? Mm-hmm. And that's what he did. And that was like revolutionary at the time.
Yeah, and I think this is the same thing that Bart Scherer did with South Pacific.
Absolutely. The best revivals do, like, you treat the text with respect in the sense of like, don't.
If they're not trying to reinvent the show, they're not trying to make the show something that it isn't, but they're trying to take the show based on solely the text as opposed to earlier productions.
Give audiences the same feeling today as they did when it opened. The same feeling of newness.
No expectations.
Exactly.
But still respecting the show.
Yes. And that Carousel was very famously called the Dark Carousel, but Carousel is dark.
Carousel is... It's about... It's not...
Nick Heidner has always
said... I don't want to say it's about domestic violence, but it's about fucking domestic violence.
No, it is. It doesn't condone domestic violence, but it is about it.
It is about domestic violence because, and domestic abuse.
And it's about toxic masculinity, because it's... Billy is a character, and I'm...
A deeply, deeply flawed character.
Deeply flawed character. What makes him...
And Julie is deeply broken. They're both hot messes.
She's highly intelligent, and yet stays in a situation that... she knows, and everyone knows, is not good for her. Mm-hmm. And he's someone who wants to do good, but literally has no idea how to do it. And rather than ask for help, he has it all turned into poison inward and strikes out at the people mm-hmm. that can help him. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a morality tale. And whereas in Lilium, the play that it's based off of, the ending is sort of like, you know, this is what happens when you hit other people, when you don't ask for help, when you don't reach out. Carousel gives it a brief glimmer of hope at the end. He was like, it's not a perfect ending for everybody, but you can find redemption in the end if you do at one point accept responsibility for your actions and try to do
admission better. Admission of fault is incredibly important.
Exactly, which is where the show ends. But people think that it's condoning domestic violence, to which I say...
I mean, it's a very, very dangerous line, because you could read it that way, and sure. you could tell the story that way very, very easily.
Well, it does,
I would prefer for it not to be that way,
And we've come so far in musical theater writing in terms of the intricacies of music and character development, but in a lot of ways we have regressed in a way, because we are less inclined to write characters that are in a gray moral area, mm-hmm. Which is where we all truly are as people. Like, exactly. No one is a saint all day, every day. Except for you. We've all done stuff that we regret that has not been good for other people. It takes a minute to think about it, because we mm-hmm. all look back in our memories with us as the victim. That's something I realized the other day. I'm like, in all my memories, I'm the victim. I'm like, and I know that's not true. I definitely have, like, done shitty stuff in my past. Yeah.
Again, not me.
No, not you. You've never done nothing wrong, except never listened to this podcast.
Okay, I've done one thing. I've done one thing wrong.
We cut 30 minutes of me crying when Charlotte says she'd never listened. But that is sort of where Rodgers and Hammerstein really kind of made their name, was these characters who felt so human because they all lived in sort of a gray area. Where, like, they might have been charismatic, but they also... you know, were very self-centered or very childish, or they were very smart, but they were impulsive, and, like, mm-hmm. who can't relate to that?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is and that energy carried over to the Stroklahoma of taking mm-hmm. another Rodgers and Hammerstein text that had a lot of sex and violence and complicated characters and mm-hmm. bringing it to the forefront, which is now the floor for Charlotte Maltby to expand upon that.
Oh no, give me something more specific to say.
Let's go on to the character of Judd, which this production was very famous for.
So, yes, Lonely Room is a song that gets cut a lot in a lot of, like, high school productions, and a lot of people say that it doesn't really fit in to the tone of the rest of the show because it's very dark. I will argue that Lonely Room is one of the most emotionally complex songs in the R&H canon, mm-hmm. if not 100% the most emotionally complex song in Oklahoma.
Right up there with Clam Bake from Carousel.
And the girl that I want ain't afraid of my arms, and her own soft arms keep me warm, and her long tangled hair falls across my face just like the rain in a storm.
Also, Shuler Hensley as Judd Fry is not only very dark and twisty, but very sweet and vulnerable mm-hmm. and emotionally fucking complicated. Mm-hmm. He makes you sympathize with this character and understand that he's not just your cookie cutter villain. He is someone who life has not been kind to him, and mm-hmm. he is working with the situations that he has. And also, Shuler Hensley kind of played him as someone who's a little bit off.
Yeah.
As someone who, like, probably is a bit on the spectrum, has some, like, mental health issues mm-hmm. and has these feelings for this girl and does not know how to handle it. And that is so much more interesting to me than, oh, he's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes him more sympathetic. And Lonely Room is a point where you peer into Judd's life and Judd's mind, and you understand that he is fucking trying his best. Mm-hmm. And, you know, life has not been kind to him, and he does not live in a world where he is able to break out of what he has. And yes.
That's beautifully said. Mm-hmm. It's important to know with characters, to make characters more sympathetic does not necessarily mean that we condone negative actions that they do, which is, and I say this coming back from Carousel and the gray areas that we were talking about, the complexity of characters. Mm-hmm. You knowing where a character comes from doesn't necessarily mean if they do something violent or vicious, we're like, well, it's fine.
It's because of X,
he's,
Y, and
Z. It's because he's complicated.
No. You can still say, I know why you did that.
Yeah.
You did a shit thing.
Yeah, but it's more interesting. It's
not, there's a difference between you did a bad thing and you're a bad person.
Yes.
And I feel like that is a huge, huge, huge difference.
Absolutely. And that is what makes drama.
That's what makes drama.
It's what makes drama.
Yeah.
That's what makes drama. Think about it. That's literally the basis of Sweeney Todd.
I was just going to say Sweeney Todd.
Sweeney Todd was a good man.
He's an anti-hero.
But he was a good man who...
Circumstances turned evil.
Yes. And, you know, we all have choices that we make, but sometimes life drives us to that fork in the road where, like, it makes you question, like, if I were in your shoes, I'm not sure what I would do. Because there's always...
Yeah.
The phrase that people like to use, and it's currently a song in Hadestown, but when the chips are down, you know, it's we can theorize what we would do till the day is done. Mm-hmm. But there are always going to be situations where that take you by surprise, that completely back you into a corner, and you might act in a way that you never thought you would.
Yeah. 100%. I mean, I myself have found myself in situations where I've behaved in ways that I would never condone otherwise, but then tracing myself, I know I've already said no.
For example, not inviting me to your bat mitzvah.
If you had gotten an invitation for my bat mitzvah, you would have said, "Who is this girl?" You did not know me yet.
I did not. But then you showed me, like, 2 years later, a video of Liz Calloway singing at your bat mitzvah. And I was like, how dare you not know me at that time?
I mean, it's fine. It's whatever. Bernadette Peters also sent a video. It's fine.
I just threw a wet paper towel at Charlotte and missed, even though she's a foot away from me. Sports! Theater kids! Speaking of bat mitzvahs, you know who's never had a bat mitzvah? Any of the characters in Oklahoma.
That is my favorite segue. Not a Jew in sight.
Not a Jew. Well, no, I guess not. Part of me has always wondered
if Ali Hakim is a little bit Jew.
Well, in this current revival in the Oklahoma That Fucks,
he seems super Jew.
Yeah, the actor they got to play him is the brother in Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and so he doesn't come across as. He's supposed to be Persian, right?
Persian. Yeah. I was about to say Prussian.
Prussian.
First of all, R.I.P.
Yeah.
Second of all,
Persian.
No.
He comes across like a Jewish boy, but that actually gives an interesting
because
idea.
He looks like a guy who's lying.
Well, yeah, because it's like, well, he is a con man, Ali Hakim.
Yeah.
So, like, what if he, and to talk about like making a character more sympathetic, what if he is an American Jew who, in order to survive, has created this persona to make himself seem more exotic, because if he's from back in the days when the South was okay with people from outside the country coming in,
right?
He was like, lol, remember those golden age days? But he's like, well, I'm not Jewish, I'm Persian. Mm-hmm. And I have all these spices and whatnot. Clearly, all of them are fucking stupid and
yeah,
and
it's
not
just
real.
You know, soap, water, and glitter.
Exactly. But like, who?
But it goes to these people who have never been outside of the like few kilometers that they live in.
Kilometers.
I've been in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, though, what a great metaphor for theater is simply soap, water, and glitter.
Simply soap, water, glitter, shake, shake, shake. Musical.
Be gay. But yes.
Glitter and be gay.
Soap, water, glitter, and be gay.
That's the part I play.
That's the part we all play, bitch.
Here I am in
Oklahoma. Different. God damn it. These segues are Tony Award worthy, everybody.
Thank you.
No, but that's something in the current Oklahoma that I didn't make the connection when it was happening, but when I walked out of the theater, I was like, I feel like that's an interesting choice and, like, could totally work. It's not necessarily in the text, but it's something you could do.
Yeah. I mean, my take on the revival of... It's also really tough because this version that we are speaking at, Stroklahoma, is so ingrained in my head and my heart.
Absolutely.
It's... For me, I felt like I was seeing a lot of very interesting directorial choices as opposed to storytelling.
Sure.
And speaking purely for my own taste of what I like in theater, that wasn't really enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather just, you know, tell the damn story as opposed to trying to project something on top of it. Mm-hmm. However, one thing that I find like super, super interesting is that the biggest fans, as far as I can tell, the biggest fans of the current Revival Oklahoma are people who have never seen Oklahoma.
Yes.
And I find that fascinating because if my takeaway is you're not really telling the story.
Or people who didn't like Oklahoma before.
Or people, actually, that's even better. There are people who've never seen Oklahoma or people who hate Oklahoma. And actually, one of my favorite things that someone said to me, ironically, Lucas McMahon, our Audrey 2, is that he feels like this...
And also is on this podcast.
And also is on this podcast. Hello. I wouldn't know.
I'm informing you, bitch.
Sorry, I thought that was with a exclamation point. said that he's like, I feel like this is a revival done by someone who hates Oklahoma.
Interesting. I didn't get that from the show.
I didn't necessarily either.
Because I went in expecting, because what you were saying earlier about, you know, directorial choices, it's one of the reasons why I don't like Ivo Van Hoffe as a director, director of Network and the most recent Crucible, and why I'm not really excited for his West Side.
It's controversial. Sure. Very controversial. I did not love Crucible.
I did not see Network. I enjoyed Crucible in a way, only because
Ben Whishaw and Saoirse Ronan.
Yes. And also because by that point...
Also, there was a wolf.
There was a wolf on stage. By that point, I had seen...
Also, such a good play. Sorry, I will not let you finish the sentence.
You will not. I had seen View from the Bridge. I did not care for it. Mm-hmm. I thought, speaking of things where I was like...
How was the view?
The view was cloudy. I was with Natalie Walker. Natalie Walker and I saw View from the Bridge together. And there was one scene in particular that's normally in the play. It's at a dinner table, and it's very... And she died. I'm not one who's like, it has to be done the way it was written, like the way it's originally, like, read the text and see what comes for you.
But there was a
scene where they normally are all around a dinner table, and it's all about how the tension builds to a point where, like, it gets to this fist fight. In the Ivo Van Hoffe production, he put them all, like, 6 feet away from each other. What a wonderful number I just came up with. 6 feet away.
Hey.
And had them each, like, take a beat before they each said a line in a very slow manner, and there was a light buzzing underneath it all. And I went, what a beautiful acting exercise that you made people pay Broadway prices for.
Because love that. Yeah.
Because I was like, I would totally do this as an acting exercise with my cast to, like, feel the tension, really get it, and then take what they got from it and put it into the scene. But after the cloudy view, and then after I saw Lazarus as well with Ali Gordon, where we famously shouted out loud in the dark, is that Alan Cumming? It's a long story, but just know that in the play Lazarus, Alan Cumming murdered Sophia and Caruso. Show was completely just bonkers.
Right.
And so I went into Crucible.
Remember the David Bowie thing?
Yeah. And I just went into Crucible being like, what are you going to do? Throw it at me.
I'm ready.
So, like, I didn't enjoy it in terms of, oh my god, what a great way to do the Crucible. I enjoyed it in terms of there's a wolf on stage. Right. They're fucking floating.
Yeah, that's the thing. If I'm sitting there and I'm seeing the director's choices, and I'm seeing the director say, ooh, wouldn't it be clever if... Immediately I'm taken out.
No, it's all about...
There are actually very, very few times that I've sat through a show that was very, like, gimmicky and actually enjoyed it. I think one of the only times was Groundhog Day. I actually, like, kind of loved Groundhog Day.
That was one of the few
times that I was like, this show has so many gimmicks and I actually am here for them because they're forwarding the plot and they're serving the show. Like, all the things where he's killing himself and all the stuff I thought was very clever, but not in a way that was detracting from the storytelling.
One day, we're going to get a stripped-down Color Purple-esque revival of Groundhog Day, and everyone's going to realize what a good show it is.
It's a great show. Here's the thing.
Speaking of complicated characters and character arcs.
Yes. I mean, here's the thing. Do we need a story about a sexist pig learning to be a little less sexist? Rather than just telling a story
at this moment in time,
maybe not. And that I remember feeling like, do I need this right now? No. Is the show great? Amazing.
Yes.
Tim Minchin is brilliant, and I literally has not gotten the break that I think he deserves.
I think that Matilda
losing Best Musical and Best Score to Kinky Boots will never not upset me.
Same. And I've made my thoughts on Kinky Boots clear on this podcast. I don't think Kinky Boots is bad. I think Matilda is
brilliant.
Truly a brilliant musical. Yes. My House is a brilliant song because it's one of the few modern musical theater songs that doesn't address the issue head on. It tries to avoid the issue that's at hand.
Which is my favorite thing to add.
That is Miller. That is Williams. That is Blanche DuBois.
That is Blanche DuBois.
That is Blanche DuBois.
Also, we can talk about fucking Streetcar because I watched that movie 2 times in 48 hours. Last 2 weeks ago.
Vivian Leigh, baby.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar.
We can talk about more things about it, but I would like to just dedicate a big chunk to this because the reason why it's called Stroke-lahoma in your world is because of
the story-driven choreography.
Yes, which Oklahoma was, first of all, very famous for doing
with the Agnes DeMille choreography.
Yes.
Agnes DeMille was a ballet choreographer and then also was the choreographer for Rodeo and for this production. And it basically, much
Look at
like
you mentioning Rodeo. I always called it Rodeo.
How dare you?
I mean, you read it, it reads like Rodeo.
It reads like Rodeo. How air. Much like how Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote the first like real story-driven musical, the choreography serves that same purpose and that same structure. And that's what makes it so incredible, both in between, the Dream Ballet, which is a ballet that tells a specific story, not according to the most recent Broadway revival, where it is a butt-scooching boot number.
Yes. My issue with the choreography in this current revival is I understand they're trying to do the same thing that the ballet has always done, which is it's Laurie's psyche on basalt.
Sure, and it was an abstract, more modern, contemporary dance.
My issue is because I don't understand modern dance or have a good vocabulary of it, I did not know what any of the dance moves meant.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's kind of the problem. And also, it just wasn't good choreography. What I mean? It just wasn't good.
You also you looked at me like I was the biggest idiot in the world when I said that. You're like, yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem.
I'm so sorry.
No, I'm just not used to people looking at me like I'm an idiot when it comes to musical theater.
Oh,
so,
honey.
Oh, honey, boo-boo child.
It's an honor to be here.
Yes, the dance.
Yes, the choreography. You can even see it in, like, The Farmer and the Cowman, how it's not just, like, a dainty little, fun, hoedown dance number. It is filled with so much tension.
Yes.
And anger and fighting. Mm-hmm. And the song, therefore, has a purpose because there is an action that Aunt Eller is playing, which is actually trying to create peace.
Yes.
And that is so interesting. And it's even the same thing with, Everything's Up to Date in Kansas City, how it's about teaching the people in his town what he learned and, teaching them these new dance moves. And, hey, look at my new trick. I just got a lasso. Yeah. Look what I can do with it. And how it's not just, and now I have a dance with a lasso. It's plot-driven. Yeah. It's story-driven. Everything has a purpose.
Well, it'll eventually travel back to the end of the show because what that number is, and again, remember a time when the South felt this way, it's the excitement of progression.
Mm-hmm.
It's the look at what's happening in the world and isn't this amazing?
And that's the essence of what the show is. Mm-hmm. It's about progress and it's about, this little patch of dirt marking its place in history.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exciting. Yes. And yeah.
Yes. And Agnes DeMille did become like a nationally known name after Oklahoma. She was a well-respected choreographer, but officially made her mark in theater with Oklahoma, with the Dream Ballet. And until the mid-90s, her choreography was,
Definitive
and canon, like Oklahoma canon.
Yeah.
And then,
much like how you can't really do Coruscant without the Michael Bennett choreography.
Yes.
It was like that.
And then enter little old blonde Susan Stroman, and she was like, hold my black baseball cap. I'm gonna come up.
Hold my beer. I got an idea.
And then came up with some choreography that to this day blows my mind.
Yeah.
Because what I love about what she did, and you can of course talk about more as it is your obsession. But I always overpower in these obsessions because I'm me. But that choreography, it's the same mentality that DeMille had, which was, again, character-driven and less of how do I break out of the DeMille mold and more how do I take that same mentality and apply it to modern-day audiences.
Exactly, and it wasn't trying to reinvent the wheel. It wasn't trying to do better than what already was. It was honoring everything that Agnes DeMille was as a choreographer, but creating something new.
Well, because the audience's tastes change and what we expect from dancing. Like, so much happened between 1943 when Oklahoma opened and 1975 when the Chorus Line opened. Like, you look at the two dances in those shows.
Completely different.
So different. And then so much happened.
But it's still ballet.
Like, the core technique and principle is there. But then 75 to 98, so much has changed. So, like, Stroman was just saying, like, I want to get audiences to feel the way they felt in 1943. You can't do DeMille anymore because there's literally, there are dance moves in Oklahoma in DeMille's choreography where it's like women are just like prancing on the stage, like bursting pretend bubbles. And it's like beautiful in a very like old school modern ballet dance kind of way.
Right.
But audiences would not know what to do with that today.
But also, Stroman's choreographer was honoring that particular production's mentality. And that's just not something that you would want in a different production. Like, you wouldn't want Agnes Noble's choreography in this production of Oklahoma because this production of Oklahoma is framing the story in a slightly different way that
it's grittier.
Stroman is honoring. Yeah,
it's grittier. It's tougher. The men are men.
I mean, if you look at the Dream Ballet, I mean, Hugh Jackman and Shirley Hensley are in the Dream Ballet.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's not pretty.
No. And that's what I like. There's a difference between professional and pretty. So, like,
yes.
So, like, dancing can be professional and still have, like, grit and toughness to it, which is what I love about all that choreography in the 94 Carousel. Like, these are working class people. They're not going to dance like they're in a SAB class.
Like, understanding that Jigger is not someone who's about to do triple tours.
Yes, but even, like, the Mill Girls, like, they dance beautifully, but not in the, like, I went to ballet and went with the Joffrey. It's the technique is there at the core of it, but character defines it and makes it different.
Exactly. Which is why it's so engaging to have the actual Laurie dancing her own Dream Ballet, is because she is an actor and you've been following her arc through that character, and then seeing her go through that whole expression is completely, it has a completely different impact than when you have someone else representing what it is you've been seeing.
Yes. And just on a purely personal level, if you do go online to watch it, because the ballet is up there, it's on YouTube. Everything we're talking about is on YouTube. Watching Josephina Gabrielle dance the Dream Ballet, in addition to it just being wonderful to see Laurie actually do it, she's so emotive when she dances. It's how you can tell she is both a beautiful dancer and an actress, because it's not just the moves, it's how she inhabits the moves.
Yeah.
And there's,
like, there's that moment in the saloon part of the Dream Ballet where she finally, like, gives into her sexiness a little bit.
Yeah, she's with the, there's a famous part in the Dream Ballet where Laurie imagines the saloon girls who are on these postcards that Judd has on his wall, like the sexy women. There's a lot of commentary in the show on sort of the Madonna and the whore complex that America is obsessed with for women. We're like, you can either be virginal and marriage material, or you can be a whore and dance in the saloon. I'm like, you can be both. Sex and the City taught us that. But you do see that moment in this ballet where Laurie joins the saloon girls and does these little high kicks with them.
Yeah.
And with each kick, she enjoys it more and more. And then you see herself hate herself for enjoying those kicks. But then you also see, because we were talking earlier, she shows up in the beginning of the show in overalls. She then puts on a clean dress and scrubs herself all nice and purty for the what's it called?
The box social.
The box social. I'm like, it's not the square dance.
Although it might as well be.
There's something about when she's...
You know, they make the lunch boxes? So it's a box social, because they do little auctions.
Yeah, the little picnic-y basket box socials, yeah. Then, but I forgot the actual name of it is all.
How dare you.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, everybody. But there's a moment in it where the stage goes completely bare for her and two other girls. These, like, twin Greek chorus-y girls. I don't know how to describe them. The one with the pigtails.
They're the two dancers. They're the ones who sort of, they start the Dream Ballet.
Yes. And they bring Laurie into it.
Yeah, they bring her into it. They're her friends, and they're playful. Well, it starts with them, this little, like, they're toying back and forth, or they take the potion, and they're playing catch with them.
Well, first, their arms shut out of the husks of corn, which is a great opening visual. Yes.
And there's a great shot that's in the DVD, but obviously wasn't in the Broadway production, when they're running through the corn maze, and you're like, ah!
Yes, exactly. And then they play, you know, catch with the bottle of smelling salt.
They all dance, and then they
go into that big ba-da-da-da-da-da, and you just see Josephina Gabrielle be this beautiful dancer, and it's almost Laurie, I interpret it as Lori, like, embracing the girly-ishness of herself for just a moment.
Yeah.
Because even if she's not a total girly girl, she can let herself enjoy being a girly girl for a minute.
Absolutely.
Because we're all complex. We all have many
exactly.
facets.
Exactly. She is both the girl in the overalls and the little girl in the dress and the girl kicking her face in the saloon. She
absolutely.
Is all of those things.
She is
and
all
that's why
things.
This production is so amazing. Not just a little doughy-eyed ingenue.
She's not. And then in Act 2, and you see that grit come back in Act 2 at the Box Social when she's alone with Judd, and you see, first of all, how nervous she is.
Mm-hmm. And how vulnerable she is, and how she really is just like a scared little girl.
Yeah, she is really actually scared of him. Mm-hmm. And Shuler Hensley is terrifying. Like, it's what makes it even more terrifying is that you see him in his most raw in Act 1 with Lonely Room, mm-hmm. and then seeing how raw he can get, and seeing her alone with Josephine and Gabrielle, you're like, what's he gonna do? I know how dark he can get. What's he gonna do?
Mm-hmm.
And then seeing her fight back and just tear into him, that's when she's like, I may be wearing a dress and I may be, you know, pretty to you, mm-hmm. but I am a woman,
yeah.
and you will respect me, and you can go away now.
Suck a dick.
You go suck a dick. Go suck a dick, Judd. That is the underlying theme of that scene.
Go suck a dick, Jen.
Yes. But yeah, like that's all the facets of Lori.
Mm-hmm.
That would, what a great other title for Oklahoma.
The many facets of Lori.
Or just facets of Lori. Lori.
Like, ooh, facets of Lori.
Like facts of life, but facets of Lori.
I was like, why does that sound like a thing?
Facets of Lori.
All right, we're not doing
that. Or that'd be a great Taylor Swift song, Facets of Lori.
Oh my God, calling her right now.
Also, side note, has anyone told you
that I look like Taylor Swift? Yes.
You don't look like Taylor Swift, but here's what you do look like. Taylor Swift at the beginning of You Need to Calm Down video. Just at the beginning when she's making herself the cotton candy martini.
You know when I look exactly like Taylor Swift is in the entire music video of Delicate from her album before
yes,
that.
Yes, where she's doing the like boppity dance.
Yeah, you're like, is she doing this on purpose? Like,
yeah.
Does she think she looks good? Is she just dancing like a fool?
Mm-hmm.
Who's to say? But it's especially the point where she looks in the mirror,
mm-hmm.
looks at her reflection, and then just makes a silly face.
Mm-hmm.
I there are many, many times throughout my life where I was like, oh my God, like, I'm accidentally becoming Taylor Swift. And then at that moment I went, no, Taylor Swift is becoming me.
Yeah. I mean, there are worse things to be than Taylor Swift, but there are no worse things to be than becoming you.
I have no flaws.
No flaws whatsoever. But
I like this running joke.
Every time I do watch You Need to Calm Down, which I've watched it many a time.
Oh, it's delightful.
The first minute where she is in her trailer and she's making herself the martini,
mm-hmm.
it's both the way she's made up and also the faces she makes. Because it's not like funny faces. It's just, it's like an attitude
yeah.
that I've seen you make faces before.
I love the mentality of that song. It's just like, it's 7 a.m.
Yeah, calm down.
Just like, you need to calm down.
Yeah. I'm like, damn, it's 7 a.m. Lover is a phenomenal album.
I mean, instant classic.
Instant classic. I don't love The Archer, but I like pretty much everything else.
It's fine.
You know what Taylor Swift didn't write? Oklahoma.
You know what Taylor Swift didn't write?
Oklahoma.
I want that on a t-shirt. I want that on a fucking bumper sticker. I want it tattooed on my butt cheek.
Although, like, could we see Taylor Swift in, like, a modern day movie remake of as Lori?
I mean, she's in Cats.
She is in Cats.
She is in Cats. Here's the thing. I think Taylor Swift is a wonderful songwriter.
Oh, she's a brilliant
songwriter.
She's a
brilliant songwriter. Oh, you call me up again just to break me like a promise so casually cruel in the name of being honest?
Why should a woman who is healthy and strong love
like a
baby
when her baby runs away?
We've been on a whale and now he's done her wrong. That's
one
thing
you'll
never
hear
me
say.
This, I have to say, this isn't the gayest episode I've ever had, but this might be the nerdiest. And
definitely
for,
the nerdiest.
And for that, I say grab my boob, Charlotte Mothy.
Honestly, I should be so lucky.
My left teat. That's one facet of Lori right there.
One of the many.
Facets of Lori.
Facets of Lori. My little pony. I was like, what is that?
Facets of Lori. Facets of Lori. That's the theme song.
That's terrible. Oh, no.
We're gonna, okay, here's what we're gonna do.
Okay.
We're gonna turn Oklahoma into a 70s sitcom starring Taylor Swift, and it's called Facets of Lori, and that's the theme song. Facets of Lori, Facets of Lori.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar.
So
I keep forgetting that we're being recorded. I just feel like
we're just talking. But I mean, we were talking a great deal about Stroman's choreography. So like that checked that box for me.
Yeah.
But so like, let's talk more about like the attitude. So first of all, we call it Stroklahoma because of Susan Stroman.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's just how we've always referred to it mm-hmm. as. And I feel like especially now in comparison to the most recent revival,
mm-hmm.
because I always just referred to that was Oklahoma to me was mm-hmm. that DVD of Hugh Jackman and Susan Stroman's Oklahoma. Sure. To me, much like the Nick Heidner version, Stroklahoma is the definitive Oklahoma.
Absolutely.
And now, because there's another revival that is light years different,
yeah.
now I think that we just coined the term as, you know...
Yeah. I'm a little less kind when it comes to Carousel. I'm like, there's the good Carousel, and then there was the recent one.
Carousel.
There's Carousel.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about Carousel, but...
But that's not what this podcast is about.
That's not what this podcast is about.
And everyone who listens to this regularly has heard my thoughts on it, so they're tired of it. So
yeah.
let's talk about Oklahoma,
which they haven't
heard me talk about that often. Talk to me about the attitude of this production that really has stayed with you.
Of the most recent production?
No,
Stroklahoma.
Of your obsession, Stroklahoma.
Well, one thing I really do love about it is that you're not watching this revival and feeling like you're watching a concept.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like you're watching Oklahoma and you're watching the story be told.
Yeah. And it does feel like it was not written a million years ago. It feels much more recent than
that. It feels much more recent, but it also, you know, it feels like a classic musical
mm-hmm.
in a way that doesn't make me want to roll my eyes. It's not, you know, flashy smiles and jazz hands, mm-hmm. but it's what I love about musical theater, which is storytelling and mm-hmm. humans and complex emotions. And it's just, it's everything that I love about musical theater. Because, you know, I've learned that, you know, a lot of the, you know, the commercial fluff and all that stuff is fantastic, but really doesn't speak to me as deeply as something more emotionally complex
mm-hmm.
as, you know, an R&H musical. And also, like, I love a book-driven musical. You know, with like, good scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very few musicals that have, like, I have had the privilege of auditioning for about 12 productions of Oklahoma. And one thing that's really fun, also not fun, is that almost every time that I've gone in for this show, I have a different scene.
Ah, that's nice.
Which is, you know, sucks because I'm constantly learning. I kind of feel like I know the entire script because I've gone for both Lori and 808 zillions of times and mm-hmm. always been doing different scenes. And working on those words is fun because these are characters who are not saying what they mean, who are not saying what they want, everything is subtextual. And it's emotionally complex and it's fun and it's complicated and it's messy and it's human
mm-hmm.
and it's something that I love so much about musical theater is that yes, it has the capacity to be heightened and completely beyond the world, and yes, where there's singing and there's dancing and there's so much that's out of the norm, but there's also, it's a way to peer into humanity and to look at it and to reflect, and it's heightened enough that you can see yourself in it, but it's also, it's all about showing what it means to be human. And that is something that this production especially just does so completely, and that's why, you know, it means so much to me.
And on top of all that, it has a shirtless Hugh Jackman.
Yes, it does.
And yes, it does. Even at, I think, 11... When I first watched it at 11, I didn't know I was gay, but I did know I wanted to dig my fingernails into his chest and just go down.
Just have that feel.
Feel it.
Yeah.
I'm not a feline person, but I wanted to dig my claws into him and stay on him like a cat on a scratch post.
Gory.
I mean, I didn't want no blood. But I just wanted to attach myself to him and never move.
I understand. I understand that. Just be like, bing.
Yeah. Like, just, you know, can I please be a clip-on earring in your chest hair? Let's call it a day. I don't know. That's the only thing I could think of that could attach myself to his chest hair.
Why would you put a clip-on earring in his chest hair?
I don't know, Charlotte.
Oh my god.
I don't know, Charlotte. Don't judge me.
It's not so much judgment as it's just, it's an Of the many images that I have had of Hugh Jackman in my mind, that is one that has not yet come up.
You know what, Charlotte? I don't know why. Why would you go on a podcast not listen to an episode beforehand to give yourself a sense of what it's about? I can't tell. I can't answer these things for you.
Why, I don't, smelly.
I wasn't going to say nothing. Can you tell me, please? No, I can't. Okay. I was going to say one of us showered today.
I had to be at work at 8.
It's okay.
It starts at 8. We can't be late. We could not, would not want to wait. This is all prime.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain, and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet when the wind comes right behind the rain.
If you could tell someone who wanted to mount a production of Oklahoma,
okay,
give them a few words of wisdom, like words to constantly think about when they're looking at the text and they're reading it.
I mean, one thing that I will say, and I don't know if this is answering your question in the clearest way, it's just like, it's important. It's probably not. But to note its place in history.
Mm-hmm.
And to really understand the many facets of why it's important.
Mm-hmm.
Both, and mostly just in terms of the structural storytelling. Yeah. And like, yeah.
No, in order to go forward, you always have to know where you've been.
Exactly.
That is how I've always felt. Which is why I don't like things that rewrite history. History is littered with undesirable stories and people and things.
Yeah.
Don't rewrite it so that way it can seem more like My Little Pony to you.
Mm-hmm.
Make it more facets of Laurie. In order to improve, you have to know what you're improving from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true in terms of musical theater as well, which is a much more shallow way to look at it. Like, I'm not talking, musical theater is a little different from like slavery and the Inquisition.
I'm sorry, musical theater is different from slavery?
Well, we have this slave play on Broadway right now, which I haven't seen, but I'm gonna assume doesn't have a dream ballet.
What a plot twist that would be.
Bitch, I would be first in line if you were to tell me that the slave play has a dream ballet.
I mean, who doesn't want a dream ballet
in their plays? You know what the ferryman was missing? A 20-minute dream ballet from that 3.5-hour play.
I will say, that was the fastest 3.5 hours of my life. Unlike Gary, which was the longest 90 minutes of my life.
I enjoyed Gary for just the sheer what the fuckery of it all.
It was just exhausting. It wasn't bad. It was wonderful. It was just exhausting.
It was exhausting. I found the first 2 hours of The Ferryman to go by in a minute. And then the third act, the first half of the third act for me was a bit of a slog.
Was that all the boys sitting around?
That was all the boys sitting around, and I'm like, I'm done. This is all to say that, yes, musical theater is a much more shallow way to look at that in terms of history, but it's the same principles apply, which is if you're going to do theater, musicals, plays, what have you, write it, direct it, be in it, you do have to have a sense of the history and the scope of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, theater didn't just start with Dear Evan Hansen.
Yeah, and also didn't just start with Jason Robert Brown.
Yeah, and it didn't just start with Les Mis.
Or Sondheim.
Sondheim?
Sondheim.
Oh.
Because you have to understand.
I was like, are you saying Sondheim from Moulin Rouge?
Oopsies. But one thing that you have to understand is that Stephen Sondheim was a student of Oscar Hammerstein II. That he was able to break the mold because he understood the mold that he was breaking.
Yes.
And he had the utmost respect for it. And yes, he and Oscar clashed and fought and, like,
sure,
disagreed on loads. But he knew the field that he was developing.
Mm.
And he knew what he was branching towards because he knew what he was branching away from.
Yeah.
And he... That, you know, that comes with respect.
Yeah. And, I mean, I would disagree with the term branching out because there is so much respect there. I would say building upon.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because as you said, there was so much respect there. And he's openly said, like, he and Oscar Hammerstein differed as night and day in terms of lyricists. Like, Oscar Hammerstein was, you know, an optimist, and he was much more about, you know, rural imagery. He loved himself some, like, bird imagery. It was, like, his favorite thing to write about. But he does say, like,
he also loves a scale.
Yes.
Well, that's Richard Rodgers.
Yeah, but it blends. But he does say, like, as a book writer, Oscar Hammerstein is peerless and, like, probably the most important person in musical theater history.
Because, I mean, if you look at Book of Mormon, structurally speaking, is a golden age musical.
I mean, their entire second act number of Joseph Gordon-Levitt, not Joseph Gordon-Levitt, just Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Joseph Smith.
The song they do about Joseph Smith is a direct homage to The King and I, Small House of Uncle Thomas.
Yeah.
And that comes because Bobby Lopez and Trey Parker and Matt Stone know that.
Exactly.
And use it.
Yeah.
Oscar Hammerstein, if there's one person that you should look to as like the grandfather of musical theater, it is Oscar Hammerstein, purely from a book writing perspective, how mm-hmm. he shaped musicals and how they sung, how they spoke, how they moved.
Mm-hmm.
That was him.
100%.
And that is no more evident than in Oklahoma.
Indeed.
I think that's a great place to end. Well, Charlotte, this has been lovely.
This has been a lovely hour and 45 minutes.
I mean, we'll see how short I cut this down to. So this has been
a lot of this has been,
Yeah, no, there's some fat that I will trim. Don't you worry, baby.
I'm very worried.
I do my best.
Worried just like for you in the process of finding the,
diamonds
in the rough.
I did keep all of the audio of me and Josh Daniel doing the Sondheim Divas from the Sondheim concert because, well, so his episode is like an hour and 19, I want to
mm-hmm,
say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We recorded for 2 hours and 15 minutes.
That tracks.
And I have to tell you, truly all of it is gold in my eyes, but I was like, I have to cut some stuff because this podcast has not gone to a point
or
yet
where we can do two-part.
We could have done a two-parter.
Yeah.
And that would have been fun, but I'm like, you know what? I think it's best that I hold on to this for a little bit. And maybe if I get to a point where people are dying to hear some of that cut audio, I will release it. Because that's one of the few raw audios that I have kept. Because
Rodeos.
Agnes Mill.
Agnes Mill, Oklahoma. Nailed it.
You know what Taylor Swift didn't write?
Oklahoma.
That's probably the greatest transition I've ever done in my life.
That is... such gold.
It's iconic. It's Gold Rush. Gold Rush, Western Oklahoma. Charlotte, where can people find you on social media?
Oh, at Seamaltz on the Instagram and on Twitter. I don't really use Twitter, though.
Letter C,
mm-hmm.
MALTS.
That's
on
me.
On Instagram and
That's
Twitter.
Me.
But if you really want to know what Charlotte's up to, follow her on Instagram.
Watch my stories. I'm an idiot.
Yeah. And you can follow me.
No need to keep that in there.
I absolutely will. You can follow me on Instagram at Matt Koplik, MATTKOPLIK. You can expect John back on the podcast shortly. I know I promised it before, but I'll say it again. If you write us a nice little gay review, John will come back and heal all the faster. Bonus points if you can include a reference to either Big the Musical, Smile, Sally Murphy, the Patti LuPone. So far we've had Smile references and I want to say an Into the Woods reference, but I could be making that up. I definitely know there's been at least one Smile reference in our iTunes reviews.
Niche.
Well, it's because I talk about it a lot.
Really?
I love Smile. But that's for another podcast. In the meantime, guys. I can't do that. Charlotte.
Yeah.
This is going to be a little tricky for you. And I have to whip out my laptop so I can cross-reference.
I'm so glad you said laptop.
My laptop. I've got to whip out my laptop. We close out every episode with a Broadway diva.
Oh.
I would like you to pick our Broadway diva, please. But it has to be one we haven't done before. So excuse me while I get my laptop so I can make sure you're not picking one we haven't done.
Am I just picking their name? What am I supposed to do with it?
Yeah. You're going to pick their name and it's going to close us out on the episode.
Is Hugh Jackman too obvious?
What? We usually do ladies.
Does Patrick Wilson count?
I mean, he makes me feel like a lady.
Damn straight.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of something that's like pseudo-rel... Mary Testa.
Ah! Yes! Write that shit down. Mary Testa.
Mary Titty fucking Testa. Mary Titty Testa.
No, Mary Titty fucking Testa.
Mary Titty fucking Testa. And then he died.
And then he died. I'm so happy.
I love seeing this joy in your face.
I have so much joy. I have been told that we should set up a video camera to record my reactions as my...
Honestly?
I've been told my facial expressions are quite interesting.
At least just for, like, the gram posts. You know what I mean? Just to compliment with like a
little, yeah, little bit of the gram.
Little, yeah, promo.
No, absolutely. Anyway, so this has been
an everlasting love.
So this has been the Broadway Breakdown. I'm Matt Koplik. You're Charlotte Maupin.
I sure is.
And tune in next time, y'all. And here is Miss Mary Testa to take us away. Take us away, titty fucker.
Mary Teta fucking Testa.
You say it like a grand name. Mary Teta fucking Testa.
I kind of just have like Liza Minnelli.
People walk by me with glee. I am what they'll never be. I don't ask you to chip your hat. I don't ask that you notice what I'm wearing.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.